to GonkCast, an Odd-Tekker podcast. I'm Gabe.
I'm Dan.
And this is a bonus episode about your emails. Plus, we'll spend some time discussing another early Odd-Tekker, Lucy, in our continued quest to cover all of Odd-Tekker's odds and ends in roughly chronological order. Lanx 3 from UK label Volumes Volume 8 compilation released in 1993. Our next proper episode a week from now will be on both of Warp's artificial intelligence compilations. We've gotten a few emails, but we know a lot more of you must have thoughts on these landmark releases in Odd-Tekker and electronic music history, so send them in, gonkcastpod@gmail.com. All right, Dan, tell us what we need to know about Lanx 3.
Odd-Tekker's Lanx 3 is the first track on a 1993 compilation album called Volume 8, which was the eighth issue of a CD-based music magazine called Volume. Volume was only around for a few years, but it was famous for producing great compilations that came packaged with CD-sized books of journalism on the featured artists. Volume 8, for example, included exclusive tracks and remixes from artists like Odd-Tekker, Underworld, B12, Butthole Surfers, Global Communication, The Fall, and a lot more. But it also came with a 192-page book, which we would love to read, but sadly weren't able to find.
Yeah, shout out to Volume and its creator, Rob Deacon, who I guess passed away in 2007. I'd never heard of this series before this week, but it sounds extremely cool, actually. Also, I know that Lanx 3 is a pretty obscure AE track, so I'll put a link in the show notes of this episode in case you haven't heard it. Now, what did you think of Lanx 3, Dan?
I thought it was really awesome. You know, like it's sort of built around this like percussion with this really great delay to it. It's like full spooky percussion, you know, on every hit, with just sort of like some synths going in the background, you know, sort of either an arpeggiator or, you know, simply programmed or something, just sort of bubbling along in the background. It changes a little bit, but it's really like all about this just pure haunted percussion going on.
Yeah, I kind of love this track. Like, I really, really, really like it.
Yeah.
It's super minimal and weird. You know, it does have that kind of like thudding percussion, like you mentioned, some like really kind of heavy clacky snare with a lot of echo on it as well. And just kind of this like this bass synth line kind of starts out in like this kind of woozy, bendy way, and then kind of gets, you know, clipped into, like you said, this kind of rhythmic pattern in a way. And it's got kind of like a buzzy, you know, almost like mechanical kind of quality. The whole thing is like just so slow and sparse, and just kind of like chugging along in the, you know, in this kind of just, I don't know, it's lazy to describe it this way, but this kind of like classic early Odd-Tekker way in my mind, you know, just like this kind of pummeling, slow, heavy chug of a thing that just keeps like driving on, even though it stays very sparse and minimal. Also love, like, you know, around halfway through, you get these kind of like this kind of bendy, almost like psychedelic synth loop or something starts running. And another thing cool about this track is that like that sound, along with a lot of the other sounds, actually are getting kind of like, you know, they're going through this like long sweep filter kind of thing where they're like getting almost like submerged underwater and then kind of like rising again. And there are points where that like kind of bendy synth thing, the like, you know, some of the few highs on this track, it just gets like very psychedelic and dreamy. I just like, I don't know, it was kind of like bowled over by this track.
Yeah, definitely. It does definitely have that, the dreamy feel to it. Honestly, was not what I expected. I had never heard this track before. I don't think I've ever even heard of it before.
Yeah.
So, you know, I was coming in completely blind, and it really wasn't what I was expecting at all.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there are probably more Odd-Tekker Lucys than we can ever, like, hope to cover, but, you know, which is good, because that means there's just tons to choose from. And I sort of gravitated toward this one. We were trying to think of something to just package in with this episode. You know, it's just a small track. It's like five and a half minutes long or something like that. But I just kind of gravitated to it because it's from 1993, which is kind of the same era we're on, right? We've been kind of working our way through Odd-Tekker's odds and ends chronologically. And we did the Warp tapes last week, and now we're getting ready to do the artificial intelligence comps next week. So, you know, Lanx 3 came out in 1993, right? The last year that the Warp tapes kind of cover. And to me, it just felt like an enormous leap forward from anything that was on the Warp tapes, because it is so much about sound. You know what I mean? Like it's almost like it's just very sound focused composition, because it's very, very simple, lots of empty space. And it's like, you're supposed to kind of focus in on just like the strange eeriness, the hauntedness, like you said, of these sounds, you know, which is so different from the kind of, you know, Night at the Club that the Warp Tapes is.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's why, you know, I wasn't expecting what we got because,
yeah,
in our discussion, you know, we picked it because it was close to the Warp Tapes. And, you know, so I was expecting, you know, that, you know, Cavity Job, Lego Feet sort of feel to it. And yeah, it's completely not that at all. It's so strange. I mean, you know, we talked about it in the Warp Tapes episode, like how different the Warp Tapes are from Cavity Job, you know, how right. You know, just a leap forward of that same sort of thing. This is a completely different thing. You know, it's like they, I don't know, it's like they mastered the craft so early on.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe didn't like 100% like release it that way. But I mean, this like makes me think of Confield more than it makes me think of Cavity
really?
Job, you know?
Like, see, I was thinking like Amber. You know, I feel like this would fit right in on Amber and would actually be a really cool track on Amber. But yeah, I mean, you're right that like even going, you could probably tie it to things like even further on. But, you know, it was kind of, I guess when I thought about it, it's like, okay, if Incunabula really is a compilation of stuff made from the same stuff that the Warp Tapes is made from, right? These demos, then, you know, we've talked plenty of times about how Autechre kind of consider Incunabula more of like a compilation and Amber their first proper album. You know, then it's really not crazy that in 1993, they were probably already working on Amber and Incunabula was like in the rearview mirror as well as the Warp Tapes and all that stuff. You know what I mean? So it's like, it sounds like so wildly forward thinking for 1993. But when I really broke it down, I was like, you know what? They probably were working on Amber at this time.
Yeah. You know, that's a good point. I didn't really think about it that way, but yeah, you're right. I mean, in the Warp Tapes, it's 89 to 93. So, you know, maybe we're getting a lot more 89 than 93 in there, but yeah, I definitely didn't think of that. You're right. Amber probably was, I mean, this easily could be like a, you know, early Amber sketch or even, you know, just something they left off, you know, that they quickly knew they were going to leave off.
Yeah. Yeah. I kind of wanted to ask that actually, that it's like, it kind of, you know, we've talked about a lot of Lucy's and some Japanese bonus tracks and stuff that feel like unfinished sketches, like they don't really go anywhere. Mm-hmm. And Lynx 3 certainly doesn't go anywhere. But for some reason, I felt like because it was such a like minimal kind of just forward propulsive chug kind of a track, it was like perfect. And the way it kind of petered out in this almost like spacey way, and then it's like just the kind of like lone bass chugs, you know, riding us out, I thought it was perfect. I thought it felt like a really fully fleshed out track, despite how minimal it was. Did you feel like it was that or more of like a unfinished sketch?
No, I do feel, I mean, it's a little hard to answer because I do feel like it doesn't go anywhere, but I feel like that's a, you know, a feature, not a bug of this. Yeah. It's you know, it's just part of its like minimal nature. And, you know, Autechre does this sort of thing, you know, later on. And so, you know, in one sense, I could see why somebody could, you know, draw that it would be a sketch, you know, from that. But I think it also, you know, completely sounds finished. I mean, you know, the synth changes, like you said, that sweeping filter comes in and all. It definitely, like, moves around. It just sort of, like, it moves in a circle rather than a straight line kind of thing.
Yeah,
And so, I mean, that feels like intentional and stuff. So maybe, you know, they just thought it wasn't going to fit the sound palette or, you know, something. You know, maybe there's some reason they didn't, you know, think it was worthy of Amber. But I think it feels more fleshed out than a lot of the, you know, Japanese bonus tracks and stuff.
Yeah, definitely. So, you know, I always like to ask at the end of this, is it something that Autechre fans should seek out? And it sounds like we both kind of think so. I mean, I honestly really, really like this track. I feel like it's the best Lucy we've talked about in a while. Really just an interesting, like all, I don't know, electricity and water is like all kind of the vibes I get. It's just like a really interesting sound design. So sounds like you agree.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. I mean, you, I agree. This is the best Lucy I can think of, like off the top of my head. So, you know. Yeah. At least in a while, and I liked Oval Moon, but I think this is better than that. It's definitely worth hearing, especially, you know, if you're a fan of the Amber, you know, kind of thing, which I am, you know. So yeah, I think it's definitely worth your time. I mean, right before, you know, recording this, I listened to it like three times, you know, back to back.
I know,
enjoying it the whole time.
Yeah. All right. So definitely check it out. Again, I'll put the link in the show notes. But okay, let's move on to the emails, starting with some comments on the warp tapes. Listener Joe wrote in to say that he thinks our point about the warp tapes being more valuable for fans of electronic music in general than Autechre fans in particular is spot on. He writes, "It took me a few months to get around to listening to it because it was a very busy time, but one of my best friends kept bothering me about it and reminding me that I absolutely had to listen. He's a big fan of warp in general, particularly Boards of Canada, but is really only into early AE. He kept going on about how mind-blowing it was and that it was one of the most amazing things he had heard in a long time. I told him that if I listened to it, he'd have to finally give NTS a try, but he ended up not liking NTS at all. I'm sure there are tons of other music fans out there like him who, if they heard the warp tapes, would have a similar reaction, but probably never will because of how deep it is in the abyss. Now, Joe had a second point on this topic as well. You want to read that part, Dan?
Yeah, Joe writes, "I think that in general, the kind of people who are big into AE are most interested in the crazy innovations that they are able to pull off again and again throughout their career, which is why so much discussion on our Autechre and We Are the Music Makers is focused on their most experimental releases. Although the Warp Tapes is interesting in terms of seeing how they developed into the group that made Incunabula and is a very fun and listenable record in its own right, 99 times out of 100, if I want to listen to Autechre, I'm going to put on something that came later just because of how much better the sounds and compositions get later on."
Yeah, I liked these two sort of points, you know, back to back, because it just sort of illustrates like what a weird, uncomfortable spot the Warp Tapes are in my opinion, which is like people who are not, you know, haven't gone down the Autechre rabbit hole, but they like electronic music, I think would really, really enjoy this, but they're never going to find it. And then people who have gone down the Autechre rabbit hole are probably not that interested in it because it is sort of pre, you know, that like forward push and exploration kind of style of Autechre. So it's like, you know what I mean? It's like, it's just too bad.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think they need to put it on Spotify too. I think that would, you know, boost the numbers on the amount of people that hear it as well. You know, it's just, if you're going to give it as a free download, you know, why not pop it on there? Unless like I think I mentioned during the episode, maybe it has some uncleared samples or something. But yeah, I mean, it is sort of in this odd spot. You know, we talked about it like reminds me of like, you know, Bob Dylan's bootleg series. You know, I think there's like plenty of releases in that and stuff that are kind of essential things. But if you're not a big Bob Dylan fan, you're not going to check out, you know, some random box set, even though it might be, you know, the best of that era or something. You know, it's sort of in that same kind of archival, like super fan, you know, territory.
Yeah it feels like super fan stuff, but it's actually so inviting and so infectious. Mm-hmm. You know, this email got me thinking about, like, it's kind of great actually that the Warp Tapes came out when they did, because if you are one of these, you know, people who went down the Autechre rabbit hole, as we obviously are, you know, it's kind of like this adrenaline shot, like, that I feel like you could benefit from returning to every once in a while. You know what I mean? It's almost like, I don't know how to put this elegantly enough, but it's like we had gone all the way through the discography and then we jumped back to Warp Tapes and it was like, wow, what a blast that was. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm,
and I feel like if you are kind of like digging into Autechre or something, and, you know, once you get to like Confield, maybe like take a week, like take a break with the Warp Tapes before you press on. It makes the Warp Tapes more impressive, I think, to like hear, you know, feel that distance between Confield and the Warp Tapes. But also the Warp Tapes are like refreshing and fun and kind of bodily and just, you know, a great time. It's almost like the fact that it came out in 2019 was perfect for me. And I just feel like so sad that I feel like there's a lot of people that aren't checking it out.
Yeah, I completely agree with you.
I guess the other thing, though, is I kind of felt like, and I meant to bring this up, but like, I kind of liked Lanx 3 more than anything on the Warp Tapes, which is weird because it's like, I mean, I guess, you know, it's early stuff, like we said, but it's like they had already very quickly started moving forward in a way that was like very exciting. So I almost wonder if that excitement I got from returning to the Warp Tape sound, you know, maybe it's a little bit fleeting then when you do start pressing forward again, you know, to Joe's point about the people who like to follow this exploration.
Well, I mean, I talked about it during the episode. You know, the energy of the Warp Tapes, like, did wear me out. You know, I didn't right. particularly like love listening to it over and over again, you know, for 2 weeks. I said too, you know, I much preferred listening to part one, you know, putting some time between it, listening to part two, because otherwise, you know, it really did just like sort of wear you out. You know, listening to Ottaker, you're not normally getting, you know, so much back to back energy. And so, you know, I sort of agree. I like Lance 3 better too, because it, you know, we're back in that sort of you know, down tempo, spooky sort of thing. You know, which is more you know, what I enjoy just in music in general.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, more from listener Joe, actually, who said, although I get the point you were making about the Warp Tapes potentially having been the Loveless of pre-artificial intelligence electronic dance music, I think that Sean and Rob themselves would probably consider that idea to be ludicrous. It's a fun radio mix of old material. Smile or Chrome Dreams, this ain't. I think it's plausible that they might have been able to construct a classic album from the material on these tapes, but I doubt it would have been structured like this mix. In fact, as you mentioned, it's entirely possible that they did release a classic album from the tapes material, Incunabula. I'm still holding out hope that one day they quietly release the entire tapes so we can find out. I, you know, he says, as you mentioned here, but I was kind of feeling like maybe we forgot to sort of address that, but it's like such an obvious and perfectly good point that like Incunabula is the classic derived from the Warp Tapes, and we got it, and it is a classic. It's great. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely don't, you know, disagree that Incunabula is a classic. And I do agree with the listener that I think if this was released, you know, contemporaneously, like it wouldn't have been this put together mix, you know, just right, two tracks. Right. It would have been more structured, more like Incunabula and everything. So I get what they're saying. You know, I still think, like, I think our point with it being like Loveless was if like the band, you know, just sort of released that, disappeared, you know, kind of thing. It would be this, which I know, you know, Loveless isn't that, but it would just become this sort of, you know, pre-Saw, like,
yeah,
you know, pinnacle like that.
Yeah. It just sounds like so, like such a great, I don't know, encapsulation of the music of that era and like the energy of that era and stuff before things get all, you know, IDM, quote unquote. But yeah, it's just so fun. I don't know why it was so funny to me, because it was like I just never said the obvious thing.
No, yeah.
Here, which is like, we were like, man, if this would have come out, it would have like set the world on fire. It would have been like just as influential as Saw. And it's like, they did that. They actually did that. And it actually is like a huge influential album. So, okay. Bad on us. All right. What's next?
All right. Listener Steve writes, I love the Warp Tapes. It's so much fun to hear elements that were later incorporated into Incunabula and Lego Feet. I hear elements of Crystal from Artificial Intelligence pop up in 3 or 4 places in the second half of the Warp Tapes. Crystal is one of my all-time favorite AE tracks, so I love hearing where it came from. He continues, I suspect the Warp Tapes predate this material. Most of the Warp Tapes don't have melodic bass lines and are much more percussive, perhaps hip-hop based or more akin to Cavity Job. The tracks that have a melodic bass line were later used in other tracks, such as the precursor to Crystal, which appears around 57 minutes on the first tape. The percussion is Crystal, but the bass line is different. The melodic bass line on the beginning of the second mix appears on Lego Feet. Steve concludes, the fact that portions of Crystal and other tracks sound like earlier versions of what was released makes me think that if Warp or Scam selected tracks from these tapes, Rob and Sean worked on them much more before they were released.
Yeah, I don't want to, you know, step too much on next week's conversation, but I, you know, I didn't realize until now that we're working on the artificial intelligence compilations, which we'll talk about next episode, that Crystal is quite present in a lot of places on the Warp Tapes. You know, it had been a long time since I'd listened to artificial intelligence compilations, and now I'm hearing Crystal. I'm like, holy shit, that's all over the second part of the Warp Tapes, as Steve notes. But it is really interesting, because on the artificial intelligence comp, it is like the same beat, but they've added this kind of lush, you know, almost like droney, like, you know, synth bass line that kind of adds like some melody and some like dreaminess. It kind of slows things down in like a more, you know, again, for lack of a better term, IDM kind of a way. Like, it gets a little bit more cerebral and heady, and there's like more sort of, you know, spacey synth and stuff added onto it. But yeah, I don't know. I like this email, because I think it must be true, right? That maybe that's why Incunabula still sounds like a forward step from the Warp Tapes is because they actually did work on them and make them more cerebral and, you know, make these demos like more IDM.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, not only possible, but likely, you know, they don't seem from everything we've read and everything they don't seem like the kind of people to just be like, yeah, that's fine. You know, we're not going to touch it. Yeah. You know, they seem very perfectionist and stuff. And yeah, I think like, you know, if Incunabula is culled from these sort of tapes, you know, and artificial intelligence had happened at that point. And so, yeah, I definitely could see them wanting to add things to it, you know, and everything. I think that's entirely plausible.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, it's, again, not trying to step on it too much, but it's like, you know, the way that Crystal at the end kind of like slows down and stuff, you know, it gets like, it's a real serious precursor to some of their like playing with time and stuff that they would do mm-hmm. later on. It just seems like, you know, it's just kind of perfect because when you think about Incunabula and you think about even the artificial intelligence compilations, it's like, what they're doing is taking the sounds of electronic dance music and they're turning it into something much more heady. And it was just kind of interesting to read this email and realize that they did that quite literally with whatever this demo of Crystal was that we can now hear on the Warp Tapes. You know, they actually quite literally took the sounds of that and turned it into something a little headier. You know, Steve also writes, I can hear elements of Bass Cadet in the Warp Tapes too. By the way, have you listened to the mixes that are exclusive to the triple 10-inch box set? They are awesome. In fact, the album version of Bass Cadet is awesome too. My sense is that you guys don't love electronic music as much as I do. Smile face. He adds, I mean to say that I love techno, but I get the sense that you guys are more selective, or at least you don't follow a lot of it. What do you think? You know, we definitely don't like Bass Cadet that much. You know, sometimes we talk shit about Cavity Job and stuff. Is it because we don't like techno?
I think that, you know, that's maybe fair. I love electronic music, but I think I mostly love, you know, experimental electronic music. Like I've talked about, I really love like, you know, 60s stuff. I love, you know, 70s, 80s, you know, like Kraftwerk and things like that. Yeah. And then, you know, the 90s are sort of, it's maybe even just a lack of knowledge too, but you know, the bit I know, you know, it just all sort of isn't my thing, you know, a lot of energy and all that, you know, not super in my wheelhouse, but I think it is a lot of, you know, ignorance on my part. And then, you know, I sort of jump back in the, you know, post-Saw, you know, Warp War world.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I do love techno, honestly, maybe more than you. And I love a lot of this, like what you would call more traditional dance music, or like, you know, unintelligent dance music, you know, if we want to use that term. But like, I love a lot of that stuff. And I've talked about this a lot, like how Autechre kind of makes me appreciate this fact. But like some of this quote unquote traditional electronic music is actually just so much more experimental than I think we give it credit for, because, you know, became normalized. We got used to it. You know,
it's, yeah, definitely,
to have tropes and stuff. You know, I will say that there are tracks that I sometimes poke fun at, like Bass Cadet or you know, Cavity Job and stuff, where it just kind of has, there are certain early electronic music tropes that I genuinely don't like. I don't think it has anything to do with techno, but it's like, you know, like these like kind of just rave ups that are just meant to like get the dance mm-hmm. floor moving. And it's just like shredded sounds, like just everything's blown out and just like, it literally seems to serve no purpose but to like get everybody moving. You know, I'm not so into that. There's other stuff I hate that, like, you know, like some of these like vocal or you know, just like little vocal samples or like little quotes of dialogue and stuff that we were talking about that a little bit on the Warp Tapes and stuff. Like, it can work, but a lot of times it just sounds so cheesy and dated to me. There's other stuff, like I was thinking about, like, God, what is that song that we talked about? I can't remember. You know, these like early 90s house anthems that just have like this really boisterous singing, like female singing over them.
Oh yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
All that.
Yeah, that was a big thing in the 90s. Like rap took a lot of that. You know, it'd be like some singer that you never heard from again in your life.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Like a lot of like Wu-Tang solo records have that smattered on it and stuff. And I agree, it's sort of annoying. But yeah, I think what you said, a lot of it is, you know, it's these things that became tropes, and, you know, maybe at the time, it wasn't so cliche and stuff, but like me at, you know, at my age, like I've only seen it in the rearview mirror, and I've never was really like a, you know, clubbing kind of person, you know, so I never had like the fun associated with it or anything.
Yeah, I'm just trying to illustrate that basically I love a lot of early electronic music and techno and more traditional forms of like clubby type dance music, you know, love a lot of it, but there are like some tropes that just sound like very dated to me. Like there's some that sound really vintage and cool to me now, but some that sound really cliche to me. And so, you know, there are certain Nautica tracks, like very, very few, thank God, that just sort of trigger that in me. Now, one last thing from listener Steve, who writes, perhaps I need to spend more time with it, but the second hour of the Warp Tapes is so much better than the first. I wonder if they tried to keep the mix somewhat chronological. I meant to bring this up during the episode. I think I forgot to, but did you ever catch yourself like wondering that? Like, cause it gets so much noisier and like just weirder as the mix goes on. And I was like wondering, like, what if it literally is 89 through 93? You know what I mean?
I don't think we did bring that up at all during the real episode, but yeah, I definitely did think about it. You know, it's one of the reasons I wish, you know, it was like delineated out into tracks. You know, it'd be nice to also say, you know, this one's from whatever year, but you know, that's too much to ask, I guess, coming from them. But yeah, I mean, it does sort of seem chronological for that thing, you know, you said about it getting more noisy and sort of experimental, but also it just like flows so well that strange that it just worked in that order or something too. You know, I don't know.
Yeah, that's true. All right, what's next?
All right. Well, listener Jordan wrote in to share a few predictions about Odd-Tucker's next project. His first guess is they will release an EP series. So it will be like what they were planning to do with XI, but Warp might let them do it this time, and they will have similar cover arts, which will probably be splats and blobs or something. They might release them in threes and space them out with a total of 9 or 12 being released. His second guess is more noise. Odd-Tucker love making soundscapes, but one element that they've never touched on are noise sounds. This is uncharted Odd-Tucker territory, and there's certainly room for this. They even did it on Marhide with how they have that noise come in. I liked it, and I need more. Perhaps that track was a clue on what they have planned. I reckon these guys are getting tired of using glitchy sounds all the time, and they want a new edgy sound. And his last guess is sounds and songs. They've done a lot with sound design, and I think their next projects will have a more equal balance of sound design and composing. They will probably do stuff with climaxes and drops, also more vocal samples like they did on Deco Lock.
Yeah, these are a lot of, you know, fair predictions. I feel like some of them are in contradiction with each other, and listener Jordan's just kind of throwing a few things at the wall and seeing what sticks. Then maybe he can claim he was right all along. But so there's a good chance, you know, that maybe this is right. I guess what I gravitate toward and think about predictions of my own of what's next for Odd-Tucker is, like, we've said this over and over again, but they always seem to just react directly against the last thing they did, right? And it's interesting reading these interviews with Sean, we talked about on the Sign and Plus episode, where he's kind of talking about Sign like almost regretting it, that it's like so straightforward and melodic and pretty, and saying like it feels too right for the moment and stuff in you know, relation to COVID and everything. But it might not even have anything to do with COVID. I just like have this sneaking suspicion that he does this literally every album. You know what I mean? By the time they put it out, he's like, oh no, this is all wrong. We got to go the complete opposite direction. Like, I wonder if that's just him as a person, you know? And that, so my point is, I feel like whatever, you know, whatever they did last time, they're going to do the opposite of it. The problem is that between Sign and Plus, they did a lot of things. You know what I mean?
Yeah. It's hard to, you know, just pick what the antithesis of Sign and Plus are. I don't really, you know, have any predictions. It's sort of, since I've been an active fan, you know, with new records, everything that's come out, I never would have guessed LSEC or even after LSEC, I wouldn't have guessed NTS. I definitely wouldn't have guessed Sign and Plus, you know, after NTS. I mean, even I was shit talking the whole Plus thing, you know, that theory and everything.
Yeah.
So I, you know, I'm not the one to predict. Although I do want to remind everyone, I did correctly predict the name of Plus.
Yep. We've gone over it so many times. You've patted yourself on the back so many times at this point. But again, I mean, you know, listener Jordan here, I feel like any of these could be right. I could totally see it. They love to play with format and stuff. I could see them like, you know, we played with the traditional LP. Let's play with the traditional EP format now or something. I could totally see that. I could see them getting noisier, but I could also see them getting songier. I feel like it's going to be what we least expect, and I'll kind of be disappointed if it's not what I least expect, to be honest. Now, speaking of predictions, listener David wrote in to clue us in on another one of AE's really obscure projects when in late 2018 they released a playlist really discreetly on their website containing a bunch of weird videos of lights moving up and down from the middle of the screen, accompanied by a huge wave of synths that seems to be related to the video somehow. The channel icon is a messed up Guestcom logo, and the playlist has exactly 444 videos, but I don't know if that means anything besides it being a reference to the track of the same name. I'll put a link to all these videos. It's like this nice Google Doc with like all the videos listed in the show notes of this episode. And I mentioned predictions here because it seemed like a lot of people, as I was researching, has thought that it was like pointing to some new release. This came out like, or this was discovered after the NTS sessions, even though some of the videos were actually published kind of secretly before the NTS sessions. But obviously nothing really happened or came of it. So I don't know. What the hell is this, Dan?
Yeah, I don't know. It's so strange. In fact, like, you know, you told me about this, you know, before doing the episode, you know, so I could watch some of the videos, and it like triggered. I was like, oh yeah, I remember when that happened. Like the thread you sent me, I remember reading that thread and stuff. And then even, you know, in reading that, yeah, of course everyone thought it's, you know, some hint to a new project or something. And then it literally just became nothing, you know. I completely forgot about it until today. I don't know. It's so strange. I mean, obviously the like Guestcom logo thing makes you think it's, you know, some sort of Guestcom thing, but nothing came out there. You know, nothing came out related to this with Autechre. It seems like a lot of work, you know, for just absolutely nothing. I don't know.
I mean, yeah, because it's weird because I couldn't quite figure out what exactly the deal was because it's no longer there, but it seems like somewhere like on the about page of the AE store, which has like nothing written really anyway, there was like a dot and you could click on it and it would just take you to like a YouTube playlist of all these videos. The YouTube playlist is now gone, but somebody saved the links to all the videos, which are unlisted videos now. And yeah, they you know, listener David described it well, where it's like, you know, it's basically like a line in the middle of the screen, and then it kind of like gets stretched out on the top and the bottom, just like this weird distorted warped image. And it seems like it is some sort of generative something is going on, that the image is like creating some like weird sort of sound. And they're weirdly like a musical. I mean, it just sounds like weird, like digital drones, but they're like, there's some like weird,
yeah, it's not like,
know, melody in them.
Yeah, it's not just like noise. You know, noise or something. Yeah, you know, it reminds me a few episodes ago we talked about how like Sean was on Twitch like messing with like Max and video and stuff and like playing Sonic and stuff with it. It makes me think like maybe it's that kind of stuff, and maybe it literally was just Sean fucking around and for some reason he put them all on YouTube or something, but I don't know. No, especially,
but it's so
like,
funny that he would have to like message, I don't know, whoever runs the AE store and be like, could you please put a secret little dot on our about page and link to this?
You know,
like,
I didn't
he went out of his
that.
Way to do that.
Yeah. Unless he has access to edit it or something,
yeah,
but
yeah.
I mean, I guess that's possible, but yeah, I didn't think of that part. That is kind of strange.
It's all just so mysterious. And I basically, you know, we don't have like any answers, obviously, but I just kind of wanted to, if other people are like you and they forgot all about this, I wanted to put it out there. And if you've got some theories or what you think about this, write us gonkaspot@gmail.com. Now, listener David also wrote, I know y'all are doing release rankings, but I think it would also be interesting if y'all did a cover art ranking as well at some point. It would be cool to see your different opinions on how their cover art has evolved over the years. We will definitely do this in the future, but I wanted to mention it because I'm really interested in doing some kind of like Autechre superlatives episode, you know, like favorite cover art, best track, weirdest track, best track to play at a normie party, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And I would love to hear some like superlative ideas from you listeners. So if you can think of any that would sort of be fun, send them our way, gonkcastpod@gmail.com. We'll do a whole like Autechre superlatives thing. Another note, we've been getting regular emails about various Autechre remixes, and I just want to remind everybody that we'll do a full episode or two or three on the remixes. So I'm holding on to all those, and you should keep them coming. Again, gonkastpod@gmail.com. All right, what's next?
Listener Steve again says, I listened to all of the Japanese bonus tracks in a single playlist like you, but I felt that P1, P2 really stood out, not just from the Japanese bonus tracks, but from the rest of Autechre's catalog. No, it's not as complex as most of Autechre's work, but it's really great headphone listening. The sounds are constantly shifting, and then if you are listening loudly on a stereo, perhaps because you turned it up to hear the quiet sounds better, the low bass rumble at 323 is striking. I love this as the closer to an album of material showing Autechre going in new directions.
Mostly just wanted to read that alongside a kind of similar email from listener Jordan, who writes, in the AE discography, Plus is different. It's not an EP, but it's different to the rest of their LPs. I think of it as a bonus puzzle album where the track names are the clues. Sign might be more of a standard straightforward album, while Plus is an album with an electronic music trivia concept. The sounds you hear, the different instruments, but it also has Sign-sounding tracks, so I suppose it's an album, like Radiohead's Amnesiac. I don't know how much you have to add to this, but I kind of liked the idea of Plus as like a half album, half sampler of new directions, maybe even some misdirections or like unsolvable puzzles or something. What do you think about this characterization?
I mean, again, you never know with Autechre. I think like if I had been a big fan, you know, when some of those other older EPs came out, you know, I would have thought they were a, you know, sampler of what's to come. And then, you know, oftentimes we see that they weren't at all. So, you know, it's hard to say, right, but yeah. I mean, you know, that definitely makes sense. I like it as, you know, thinking of it as, you know, Amnesiac, which is especially good because, you know, Kid A and stuff was like inspired by Autechre. Right. So it would be nice to, you know, go full circle on that.
Yeah. I mean, I know that, like, I have kind of mixed feelings about Plus, but I got to give it credit where it's like, I just can't figure it out. And it makes me think about it a lot. You know, it's like something kind of magical, because I was thinking about like some of my other less favorite Autechre albums, like let's say Draft, right? Draft, I totally get it. It's like a little bit of Confield and a little bit of like, we want to sort of retreat from Confield and like throw some bangers on here as well. And it makes for a sort of disjointed experience. But, you know, sort of an album flow that I almost can't even understand, but I get what they were going for, and I don't really like what they were going for that much. But Plus is like, it's an unsolvable thing like that, and it's kind of captivating for that reason, which is like maybe something I like a lot about it.
Yeah, definitely. I feel the same way. You know, Draft is the lowest record on you know, LP on my ranking list. And yeah, same thing. Like I understand it. It's not for me. But yeah, Plus is definitely like one that I, same way, you know, it's not one of my favorite records. It's not one of my least favorite records either. You know, it's sort of in the middle because of that, like, you know, puzzle to it. It's, I mean, you know, like, you ever watch a movie and then you're like, I didn't really enjoy that movie, but you just like think about it for so long that it like, you know, maybe even like maybe directly after watching that movie, you're like, that kind of sucked. But then 3 days later, you're still like, but what, you know, thinking about, you know, what was that? What was this? And then you like sort of, you know, maybe a week later, you're like, that movie kind of rocked, you know?
I do that a lot, like with music as well, like with like, Trout Mask Replica or something. I mean, it's Plus is probably not as good as Trout Mask Replica, but it's just like
definitely not. No.
I listened to it like 10 times and I was like, what the hell? What the hell? And I could not stop thinking about it, you know? And it was like, that was its magnetism like working on me, you know?
Yeah. Definitely. I mean, Plus has that, you know, that sort of, you know, magnetism to it.
All right. What's next?
All right, one more from listener Jordan, who says, also, Marhide is a great track. Some might meme on it for being simple and scoff at the 808, but it sounds good, and it's not like the background noise is just basic noise. It's fucking good-sounding noise that sounds purposeful. It doesn't matter if it's just beats and background noise, because it simply sounds good. It's a mood track. You're not supposed to listen to Marhide. You're supposed to feel Marhide. Where does the track place you? Does it make you feel at ease? Does it make you think of fresh air?
You know, again, I feel like we've talked about Marhide enough. We've gotten other emails about Marhide, but I just wanted to put this Marhide defense out there. I want you know, this to be a communal thing, so the Marhide defenders can have equal footing, you know, to voice their concerns. But you know, I felt like it was only fair because we have been the ones memeing on Marhide so much.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, a lot of, I don't hate Marhide. It's mostly memeing, you know. It is sort of like a fun little inside joke and stuff. You know, it's not my favorite track. The 808 is a little annoying, but yeah, you know, it's mostly a joke.
All right. There are defenders. There really are. All right. Last one from listener Joe again, who writes, I wanted to say congrats to Dan for staying married as long as you have. Getting married is the easy part. Maintaining a healthy relationship is the real trick. Do you feel better, Dan? Last bonus episode, Dan was upset because people were congratulating me for getting married and nobody had shit to say to Dan.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you. I did. I actually read that. I don't do a lot of email reading. You know, that's mostly you do all the heavy lifting here. I actually did read that email and I meant to write it back. But I'll just say it now, I guess. That was very nice. I did think it was a very nice sentiment.
All right. Well, Joe also had a few questions that are a little outside of our wheelhouse, but hey, why not? He writes, if you decide to do Boards of Canada or Richard D. James as your next podcast topics, you're actually totally off the mark with your guests that there are already podcasts out there about them. There really aren't, and I think you guys could do a great job covering them. One piece of food for thought regarding Boards of Canada, although I absolutely love their music nearly as much as I love Autechers, I always wonder how much of my enjoyment of BOC has to do with growing up with laser discs in science class, trippy 80s, 90s Sesame Street segments, PBS documentaries, etc. You've been getting into the idea lately of how Autechre have very subtly been honoring different types of early electronic music and even their most recent and experimental work, but nostalgia is obviously far more at the forefront of Boards of Canada's work. I have to wonder how it will sound to young people 30 years from now who understand the cultural detritus of the 80s and 90s as well as we understand the 30s and 40s. Is BOC's music timeless in the same way we assume Autechre's is, or will they sound different to the people who come after us who are disconnected from our cultural context? Again, I don't know how deep we want to get into Boards of Canada right now, but I thought it was a really interesting question.
Yeah, that's super interesting because, you know, he's right. I remember in middle school having like laser discs of, it was always in science class too. Yeah. It's really weird that he says that. Yeah. I remember the teacher had like a little barcode scanner that would like jump to the section or whatever. But yeah, you know, I wonder like, you know, does a kid, you know, half our age or something, do they even know what the hell a Laserdisc is? In fact, actually, like I spent a lot of time going to thrift stores and stuff. And me and my wife were at an antique store the other day. I was looking through records and they had a stack of Laserdiscs next to them. Wow. And she didn't know what they were. She's only like a year younger than me. She didn't know. She asked me what they were. You know, so if she doesn't know, I assume, you know, I don't really know many kids, but if any of you are a kid, you know, email in, tell us if you know about that. But yeah, no, I think it you know, will kids understand you know, the VHS sound and you know, even just saturated like tape noise. I think maybe that will stick around more than you know, the video kind of thing, because you know, like Instagram sort of started like, you know, mimicking that, you know, like the Polaroid and you know, it used to have like filters of like, you know, old VHS tapes and stuff. So I and then, you know, there's plenty of music that's popular today. I think that does the tape thing, like Mac DeMarco and stuff. I think is kind of drenched in that. So I think, you know, it sticks around more than, you know, 30s and 40s sort of things. I think like maybe, you know, in 30 years, people will just think like the Boards of Canada, like, oh, that's because, you know, when they recorded it, that's just what things sound, you know, yeah, like, will it become like that, you know, like where it just like the it being, you know, an anachronism, like is so detached that it just, you know, becomes of its time.
Yeah, that's a good point, actually. It might be. Yeah, that's funny. It's funny. That's such a tech dad moment where like, your wife asks you what is a laser disc?
Yeah.
I can imagine your eyes lighting up like, oh, let me tell you about laser discs. But
yeah, I was pretty stoked. Yeah,
yeah, but I mean, it's an interesting question because, yeah, you were kind of getting at this, but I feel like Boards of Canada, they kind of create this like interesting nostalgia for something that like doesn't exist. You know, it's kind of like that kind of 80s and 90s kind of like, I don't know, public access television kind of like a thing, but it's like, you know, kind of weird and haunted and like kind of in this haze of, you know, something different, you know what I mean? So it's like, it would be interesting if people like thought like that's oh, that's what the 90s sounded like, or something like that, you know, with, if enough time had passed. But the question I got, you know, in relation to Autechre as well, is like, it's possible it will age better than Autechre, you know, because a lot of times it's the stuff that's trying to be forward thinking that ages, you know, the most, you know what I mean? Because it's like, oh, that's what they thought the future would sound like. Whereas stuff that's like kind of nostalgic, you know, might actually be immune to that. And maybe people won't even realize that it's meant to be nostalgic, but it'll still be like beautiful, just gorgeous, you know, still give you that nostalgic feeling, maybe even more so. And it's true that I feel like a lot of young people, you know, like, what's this like new person everybody's talking about? Olivia Rodrigo, is that her name?
I've had to listen to that with the wife.
Yeah.
Literal like, Disney Channel music.
Yeah. She has this like 90s throwback thing going on. And I'm almost certain didn't experience any 90s or anything like that. So it's kind of like this weird warped version of the 90s is coming back right now anyway. So anyway, long-winded way to say, I will be very interested to see. And hey, maybe if we do end up doing episodes on Borders of Canada, we'll get to talk a lot more about that. One last thing, listener Joe added, I understand this question might be a little bit outside the context of the show, but since Dan already got into a 5-minute analysis of Rough and Rowdy Ways last time, it would be awesome if you could discuss this a bit in the next bonus episode. Speaking of which, Dan, what are your top 5 Dylan albums? I don't know if you have 5 prepared. I just wanted to bring this up because, you know, listener Joe, he writes in a lot. He writes these fantastically detailed emails, and he's often using like Bob Dylan analogies to describe things that I usually cut out because I feel like few people will get them, even though I know you would. I don't know if you have it offhand, but like, what are your favorite couple Bob Dylan albums?
It's hard just off the top of my head, but I mean, Blonde on Blonde is not only the best Bob Dylan album, it's the best album ever made. But Blood on the Tracks is definitely my second favorite, which I always say, you know, would be the greatest album of all time, except he fucked up and already made the greatest album of all time. I'm thinking, you know, after that, you know, probably I really love John Wesley Harding. That's maybe number 3. I'm a huge Desire stan, I'd probably put that in there somewhere. You know, Highway 61, obviously, you know, a masterpiece. I just feel like that was the first Dylan album I ever heard and stuff. I just feel like I've run it into the ground a bit. But, you know, it feels wrong to not put it there. But really, can I put the just complete Basement Tapes as number 5?
Sure, sure.
Not the, you know, 75 overdub filled, right, you know, compilation, either the untouched complete Basement Tapes.
Yeah, that would be pretty high for me as well. Love all those records. Probably Blonde on Blonde is my favorite, but I'll just say that I feel like I'm like on this island where I just adore another side of Bob Dylan so much more than anybody I've ever met. I don't know why. Love it.
I think that is honestly one of the best of, maybe the best of the acoustic records. It's so underappreciated.
Yeah, because it's like fun and it doesn't get too political. Like if you're just in the mood for like just some of his like great songs and stuff, and you don't want like an 8-minute, you know, diatribe against, you know, whatever exploitation of like migrant workers or war or something, like, you know, it's like sometimes you're in the mood for that, sometimes you're not, sometimes you just want another side of Bob Dylan. That's what it's perfect. Yeah, but all right, there can't be too much crossover between Autechre fans and Bob Dylan fans, so we should not go on much longer, but hopefully you appreciated that, Joe. And that's it.
Yeah. Well, if you, you know, have any thoughts, opinions, hot takes you want to share, or, you know, want to talk about Bob Dylan, send them in, gauntcastpod@gmail.com. Maybe I should give my personal email for the Dylan ones. Next episode in a week, Artificial Intelligence 1 and 2. Again, send us your thoughts, gauntcastpod@gmail.com. If you like the show, help us out. Subscribe, leave us a 5-star review wherever you get your podcast. Look us up on YouTube, stay connected, Twitter, Instagram @gauntcastpod, and we'll see you next time.
See you.